Opposition number 16778, reel 1.
Mr. Heppel, reel 1. Where were you born, please?
In Preston, Lancashire.
Which year was this?
1922.
What did your father do for a living?
He was a corn merchant.
Did you go to school in Preston?
Yes, I went to Preston Grammar School.
How old were you when you left there?
It was in 1939. I would be almost 17, not quite.
Did you get a job when you left?
Yes, I left to be articled to the town clerk of Preston as a prospective solicitor.
What were you doing when war broke out?
I started in the April of 1939 with the town clerk, and of course I was continuing there when war broke out, and continued there until I joined the army.
What was your reaction when you heard the news that we were at war with Germany?
I was rather worried because I was too young to get into it. I didn't like the idea of sitting at home not doing anything. And so I joined the civil defence at the town hall, which was just, the control room was there, and I did duty in the control room. And then as soon as the local defence volunteers were formed in 1940, which of course became the Home Guard a few weeks later, I joined that as an aid to doing something towards the war effort.
Had you been full of patriotic feeling when the war was declared?
I suppose so, and I didn't like what was going on in Germany. I went there in 1938 on a school trip, and it was most obvious to us just what the situation was as regards repression of the people, frightened to talk to you and that sort of thing.
Any incidents that happened to you there that you can recount?
In Germany?
Yes.
Yes. We were staying at a youth hostel at Boppard, on the bank of the Rhine, and the man in charge of the hostel came into our bedrooms and started nailing up blankets over the windows. And we asked him why, and none of us spoke any German to speak of, and he spoke no English, and he pointed to the light and waved his finger round and made a buzzing noise. And we wondered whether there were large insects that were going to invade us from the Rhine if these blankets were not put up. But of course, when darkness fell, we realised what it was. It was a practice blackout. And this was at Easter 1938. And a friend of mine and I went out and walked along the banks of the Rhine and fell in with a group of SS men who were patrolling and who seemed to think we shouldn't be there. But when we spoke to them and they realised we were British, they did nothing about it.
What was your experience in the Home Guard like?
Well, it was very interesting. We were north of Preston. And Preston didn't have any air raids to speak of. Only one or two bombs fell in Preston. And we had various patrol points. The training was quite good, too. It was of use when I did join the army, particularly with shooting and that sort of thing. And The whole business of the Home Guard at that time was, in my opinion, very, very good indeed. We were badly armed, of course. I remember once setting out, three of us, one with a rifle, one with an air gun that didn't work very well, and one with a shotgun with a dent in one of the barrels. We were strictly ordered not to fire that particular barrel if necessity arose. By the end of 1940, beginning of 1941, we had reasonable arms and equipment. We even got some pikes issued to us, but I don't think anybody ever did anything with them.
What kind of people were in it?
Well, there were some young ones like myself, and there were some rather more elderly. The officers all had served in the Great War, and the sergeants had too. as far as I can recollect. We had a very good sergeant major who had been a regular sergeant major, and altogether a very happy band of people.
Did you think the Germans would invade?
Well, we thought that there was a possibility of it, but I never really feared invasion very much. We had very careful instructions what to do in the case of invasion. We had to keep all traffic off the main road, the A6 road, so that army vehicles could travel to abreast up it, that sort of thing, but never really thought that they would be able to come.
Did the units have a number or name?
I honestly cannot remember now what the unit was. No, I can't remember.
Presumably it was just the Preston Home Guard.
No, it wasn't Preston Home Guard. We were north of Preston. It was Fulwood and Broughton. Fulwood is a part of Preston now, but it was a residential suburb in those days, and Broughton a village. And we actually had our headquarters at Broughton.
How did you come to be in the army proper?
Well, I was. I had to register for service, and I chose the army. And I was about to take an examination, and so I asked if I could have a short time deferment to take the examination, because I didn't know when I would be called up. It might have been a week or so after registration. That was granted without any difficulty. I took the examination and heard nothing more, so I went along to the recruiting office and tried to volunteer for the Loyal Regiment, which was our local regiment. But I was told by the recruiting officer, who was a member of the Loyal Regiment and had a VC actually, he was very keen to get me in, but it was pointed out to him by his ATS sergeant that once a person had registered for military service, they could no longer volunteer. So I had to wait until I was called up, which was not until November 1941, when I was called up to join the Royal Corps of Signals and went to the 3rd Signal Training Centre at Prestatyn.
What was the character of your training with them?
Well, there was 6 weeks in the depot, just on the square, and rifle drill, all that sort of thing. And I was selected as a prospective operator, wireless and line. At that time, pretty well anyone who could read and write was chosen for an operator, because there was a shortage, and the Armoured Corps apparently were calling for wireless operators to man tanks. But I did not do my operator's training at Prestatyn. I was posted, along with a number of others, to a unit in Putney, which was called the 1st Artillery Signal Section Training Battalion of the Royal Signals. And there we were trained as wireless and line operators to the group E, grade E, trade test, which involved a speed of Morse of 12 words a minute. And then we were trained on to 25 words a minute. But we didn't actually take the trade test for that speed at that unit. In the meantime, I'd applied for a commission, and so I was taken off the end of the training course. I was made a local acting unpaid Lance Corporal, and put on some administrative duties. I'd been trained, as all people who'd applied for a commission had been, in motorcycling. The Royal Corps of Signals, of course, prided themselves on their motorcycling abilities. And I did some minor dispatch riding work while I was waiting to go to the War Office interview. And I went to an ordinary interview with five officers, I think it was, and pass that. At that time, they were just beginning the War Office selection boards, which were quite complicated, and people were sent to a country house for a weekend and given all sorts of tasks to do. But I avoided that and just had a conversation around a table with a board of officers.
Can you tell me about your voyage to the Far East in 42, please?
Yes. I was told that I would be sent to India as an officer cadet, and along with a considerable number of others. And we sailed from Liverpool on the Orion June 1942. It was a troop convoy and was supposed to be a fast convoy. It wasn't all that fast, but we were well protected. We had the battleship Malaya in the convoy, and she had two Walrus aircraft which she would catapult off every morning, and they flew round, and the same thing happened in the evening. And then, of course, we had a lot of destroyers as well. And we went round the Cape and called in at Durban, and then arrived at Bombay in, I think it was August, 1942.
Now, this was the time of the Quit India movement.
Yes.
In India. Did you have any experience of that?
Well, very little. The day we arrived in Bombay, we didn't actually dock. We were anchored, and we could see a lot of signal lamps flashing, and I read one which said Gandhi had been arrested. So we realised that there was trouble. We were allowed to go ashore the next day, but we had to move in parties of not less than six, and we carried sidearms and bayonet. And we were strictly limited as to where we could go. We did see something of a mob in the distance, but they must have been a quarter of a mile or so away down a long road, and they seemed to turn off down another one, so we never came in contact with anybody there at all. We went about to Bangalore, where the officers' training school was, by train, and no trouble on the train at all. When we got to Bangalore, one of the first things that we were given was training in mob control, in aid of the civil power. And it was very, very strict training. We were taught to form up in a box to fill the whole width of the street. Two ranks at the front, one rank at the rear, and one rank down each side. In the middle of the box was the officer, and there would be a magistrate, and two people with a banner on poles telling people to disperse, and a bugler. And we were taught to advance down the street, filling the whole width of the street, the people at the side watching the roofs on the opposite side of the road. And when we got near to the to a mob that was misbehaving, we were taught that the front rank would kneel, the front would stand, the rank at the back of the box would do an about turn. And all this had to be done strictly in time and very smartly. And then the rifles all came down together. The magistrate would harangue the mob, and if they didn't disperse, he was then supposed to sign a form authorising the officer to disperse the mob. And then the instructions were that the officer would select a person in the mob who seemed to be causing the most trouble and order one of the front rank to shoot him. There were no volleys to be fired. There were single-aim shots at specific people. Luckily, we never had to do this because there was no particular trouble in Bangalore at the time. Most of the trouble, I think, was up in the north. Bangalore, of course, is in the middle of the Deccan and in the state of Mysore.
Now, although you seem to have seen very little of the Quit India movement itself, you were telling me earlier, off record, of a story you had heard. It's a second-hand story, but perhaps yes. You could record it, about the fate of two British officers on a train.
Yes, well, the story that I heard, and I know confirmation of this other than hearsay, was that a train pulled into a station where there'd been a lot of rioting. There were two British officers on board, and a mob gathered round the carriage. They had both had pistols, but somebody in the mob said, throw your pistols outward, don't harm us, and we won't harm you. They did that, and then they, the first one stepped out, and there was a man sitting on the roof of the carriage with a sword, and he took his head off. And the other one was killed as well, and then they fastened them by their feet to the back of a tonga and dragged them round the streets in triumph. A short time later, another train arrived on which there was a party of Gurkha police, and they found out what had happened, and they went into the bazaar, and they caused a considerable number of deaths, I'm told. But as I say, this is pure hearsay. that was the sort of thing that one was always afraid of, being attacked if one was on one's own or in a very small party.
Any idea where that was supposed to have been?
No, it was somewhere in the central provinces, I believe, but I've no idea of the actual place.
Did you feel at all apprehensive as you went about in India?
No. Not at all. One, of course, didn't go into the Indian cities generally. Now, each major town in India would have a city and then a cantonment, European quarter, where there would be troops and the bungalows of the officials and so on and so forth. And, of course, a number of the wealthier Indians living there as well. Well, we remained more or less in the cantonments. We didn't go into the cities particularly. And certainly I never had any problems at all or any particular fear.
What was the demeanour, the attitude of Indian civilians to you as you went about?
Generally very good indeed. Generally very good. I never had any problems at all.
Were any comments passed to you about the political situation or British presence in India?
Not me personally, no. I met, of course, a lot of Indian officers, and they never commented at all about such things.
Did you make any Indian friends?
Yes. For a time, I was attached to the Ordnance Corps, and there were a lot of Indian officers in the Ordnance Corps, and Indian civilians as well. I got on very well with them indeed.
Now, what was your attitude towards going into operations against the Japanese?
Oh, I was perfectly happy about that. The trouble was that it took me a long time to actually get into operations against the Japanese. But I didn't like them, and I didn't like the things that they'd been doing.
What specifically?
Well, treatment of prisoners of war and things of that sort. I mean, we didn't know, of course, about what was happening on the railway from Thailand to Burma, the Three Pagodas Pass Railway. We didn't know about that until after the war, but I did meet one officer who had actually been captured by the Japs and had escaped. His treatment was very bad indeed.
What did he say?
Well, he said he was beaten up, and then his hands were tied behind him, and he was led through the jungle. He wasn't provided with any food or anything. He tripped over a big stone, and when the guard who was behind him and had a piece of rope fastened to him, when he thought he'd come to this stone, he pulled hard on the rope, and the guard fell over the stone and let go of the rope, and he ran away in the jungle. And he wandered for quite a few days with his hands tied behind his back until he met a hillman who cut him free, and he got back. He was an officer in one of the parachute regiments.
What preparations did you personally make for meeting the Japanese?
Well, none particularly. I was posted not until April 1945. I arrived with the battalion in May 1945, but I made no special preparations at all.
Can you tell me about joining the Gurkhas?
Yes, when I was commissioned, before we were commissioned, we were asked what regiment we would like to go to. We were asked to give three choices, and I just put down any Gurkha regiment three times, you see. And I was actually posted to the 3rd Queen Alexandra's Own Gurkha Rifles, whose regimental centre was at Dehradun. And I arrived there just before Christmas 1942, and I was well received and enjoyed myself very much there. Fortunately, part of the time was taken up by being escort to a British officer who was being court-martialed, not a member of our regiment, I may say, and that was rather wearing, because I'd actually sat in on the court-martial and I knew what the result was, which had not been promulgated, and he didn't know what the result was, and it was a little embarrassing sitting guarding him when I knew what was proposed, and he knew I knew what was proposed, but I couldn't tell him. But apart from that, it was very pleasant, and Dehradun was a very pleasant spot. The foothills of the Himalayas rise up immediately behind it, and I was second in command of a training company where we were getting the Gurkhas straight in from Nepal and starting to train them, which of course was a somewhat difficult task. If it wasn't for the fact that Gurkhas are so terribly keen soldiers, it would be well nigh impossible to do it in the time that we had. To take a man from the hills who has possibly never seen a wheeled vehicle in his life and to make him the driver of an army vehicle is a difficult task, and to make him a wireless operator also is a difficult task. But of course they were so keen that they practiced and concentrated completely on becoming good soldiers. If you went round their lines at night, they had big mirrors fastened to the wall by the barrack huts, and you would see them practicing saluting and doing about turns and things of that sort in front of the mirrors. Now, British soldiers could be very keen, but never as keen as all that. So they were very good men to be with. But unfortunately, I hadn't been there more than a few weeks when I was told that I was being transferred to the Indian Army Ordnance Corps. Now, the reason for this was that the Ordnance Corps was short of officers, and apparently it had been decided to ask for volunteers from the infantry. But instead of asking for volunteers, they just told every regimental depot to send so many officers. Two had to go from our regiment, and as I was the most recently joined, together with another man who had been in the officers' training school with me, we were chosen, and we were told we had to go, but if we could get back without a bad report, we would be very welcome. So I was sent to Allahabad Arsenal, and that was very interesting. The arsenal was situated in the fort at Allahabad, And the fort itself was, of course, quite an ancient building, built just near the confluence of the Ganges and the Jumna. In fact, the Jumna actually washed the walls of the fort on one side. And while I was there, there was a very big religious pilgrimage, the Magh Mela, where I think it was about 1 million, they estimated, had come to this spot. And they all had to come into the fort because there was a very sacred little temple in the fort and a bow tree. And so they all came in, shepherded in by troops. And it was a most interesting experience. Unfortunately, Allahabad is a very hot place, and I was there during the hot weather. And from the climate point of view, it was not at all pleasant. However, after a few months, we met the Director of Ordnance Services, and he said that he only wanted volunteers. Anybody who didn't want to stay in the Ordnance Corps could go back to their regiments, and that is what I did. About August 1943, I got back to the regimental centre. And then we were allotted a place on a long infantry training, signals training course at Pune. And with my experience in the Royal Signals, I was chosen to go on that course. And I did so. And after I came back from it, we already had a well-qualified signal officer in the regimental centre. So I was posted to a jungle training battalion. It had been realised that it was necessary, after troops were properly trained, to give them jungle training, because jungle fighting was somewhat different to the other sorts of fighting. And so the 10 Gurkha regiments were concentrated into 5 jungle training battalions. And the one I was sent to was called the 38th Gurkha Rifles, because it was a combination of the 3rd and the 8th Gurkha Rifles. There were 10 regiments numbered from 1 to 10. The first 5 had titles. King George V's Own, King Edward VII's Own, Queen Alexandra's Own, and so on. And we were in a division called the 39th Division in the jungle, not very far from Dehradun. And I was made signals training officer there, and responsible for training the Gurkhas in signals. They'd already had some signal training. They knew the Morse code and all that sort of thing. But the difference is that one met in the jungle because communication was not as easy. And I also trained British officers. And in fact, I finished up training Brigade Headquarters British officers in the new signal procedure that had been brought in some months before. This was the verbal procedure that was to be used on radio. And I stayed there for until April 1945, when I was posted to the 1st Battalion of the 3rd Gurkha Rifles, who were in Burma.
At this stage, perhaps you can say what you thought of the soldierly qualities of the Gurkha soldier, apart from his keenness to learn the skills.
Oh, they're excellent.